This quiet community of simple farmers, untouched by time, a gruesome secret has been protected for generations. Into this world come three young women, drawn by the beauty of the land, unaware of the mystery it holds. How could they have known that what they would discover would call forth a deadly blessing?
Your laws cannot crush the incubus. Ours can.
There are three of us. We'll manage.
We shall make it impossible for the incubus to rest comfortably in your soul. If thine hand offends thee, then in God's name, cut it off!
The incubus has arrived. Those who will not believe. Those who will not be warned.
May you be damned in hell.
Those who will defy its power. Become its prey.
It's him!
The chilling story of terror and suspense. Deadly Blessing.
Hello and welcome to episode 4 of Craven Craven, the podcast devoted to the films of Wes Craven. I am one of your co-hosts, Patrick Bromley, joined, as always, by my wonderful co-host, Heather Wixon. Hi, Heather.
Hello, and blessings to you, Patrick.
Oh, blessings to you. What kind of blessings?
I think we have some deadly blessings today.
That's right. We're talking about Deadly Blessing, Wes Craven's sort of written and directed film from 1981. He has a co-writer credit on it and, of course, directed it. This is his first time working with a big movie star in Ernest Borgnine, right?
Yeah, little Ernie Borgnine in there.
Ernie B.
Yep. So I knew, it's funny, we were just talking about this and we're like, oh, we should save all this gold for the show. But it was funny because I actually thought I hadn't seen this. And then about 20 minutes into the movie, I realized, oh, yes, I had seen this. So clearly it stuck with me all these years. But it's going to be a good movie when you've got a narrator.
Yes, and what narration it is. Should we save our Craven connections for the end, or should we start with Craven connections?
Dealer's choice. What do you think?
Maybe we should wait till the end. I don't know. I just feel like if we do, we'll have covered all of them by the time we get to the end. But
that's true.
There are connections, obviously, to his other films. I didn't see this movie until the Scream Factory Blu-ray, because I think it was kind of hard to come by for a number of years. And Scream Factory, you know, is doing the Lord's work and has really helped raise, I think, awareness and helped preserve the catalog of certain filmmakers, including John Carpenter. They put out so many Carpenter movies. They put out a lot of Tobe Hooper movies, and they put out a number of Wes Craven movies. And I love that they're preserving some of these directors' arguably lesser known films. Something like Deadly Blessing might not even be on my radar had it not been for that Scream Factory Blu-ray. So I'm really grateful for them.
Yeah, it was funny, as I mentioned to you, like, I do remember seeing this movie. I honestly, for some reason, watching it, I don't even remember thinking it was a Wes Craven movie. But I don't remember if I feel like it was probably right around the same time as, like, Nightmare. So I don't know that I necessarily made the connections as a kid. But it's, you know, it's funny, watching it, or rewatching it, I should say, totally reminded me of, like, this is like more of a horrified version of Witness.
Yeah, it's interesting because it is,
but less sexy.
Slightly less sexy than Witness, because there's no barn raising scene, but it's a mix of a slasher movie and a supernatural film,
which it really only doesn't really reveal that until like the last 5 minutes, really.
Right, and yeah, spoilers for Deadly Blessing, by the way, if you've never seen it, we're going to be spoiling the hell out of it. But like, there are like the dream sequence with Sharon Stone. There's little touches of like supernatural stuff, but that's essentially the formula that would lead to A Nightmare on Elm Street, which is essentially a slasher film with supernatural elements, you know? So this movie is a really fascinating kind of warm up to what I would argue is his first masterpiece.
Yeah, absolutely. I especially felt that during the bathtub sequence with Martha.
Yes, there's one of our Craven connections that he
yes
has a bathtub sequence where Martha. Well, let me quickly read the plot synopsis IMDb.
We should break down the compelling nature of the narrative behind Deadly Blessing, because it's not one of Craven's finest. Let's put it that way. It's a pretty innocuous movie. Like, it doesn't bother me. It was fine, but like, it's probably not one I'll watch like a ton, maybe.
Well, no. And I don't see a ton of him in it. I mean, there are certainly elements like the one we're about to talk about. And honestly, the ending is so batshit that it makes the movie stand out. But it also, I think, is a huge disservice to the movie and kind of ruins what came before. This is the plot synopsis from IMDb. After her husband dies under mysterious circumstances, a widow becomes increasingly paranoid of the neighboring religious community that may have diabolical plans for her.
So those damn Hittites.
Right, who are not Amish, but might as well be Amish. They made up a religion to sort of stand in for the Amish. But it is a world in which the Amish exist, because there's a line that talks about how the Hittites make the Amish look like swingers. But the scene that we were talking about is Martha, who's our protagonist, played by Maren Jensen, in, I believe, her last screen performance. She had kind of a brief career, and this was her last movie, is taking a bath, and we get that shot, that famous shot of her legs kind of sticking up out of the water, and we're down at the water level, exactly like we would see with Nancy Thompson in A Nightmare on Elm Street, only instead of Freddy's glove in Deadly Blessing, it is a snake that has been placed there by a mysterious assailant.
Ooh, yes. It was, I mean, I'll be honest, she handled that scene far better than I probably would have. Because if I looked up and there was a giant snake in the bathtub coming towards your lady parts, you know, it's cause for alarm.
She was quick on her feet. She ran and got the fire poker and beat the shit out of it.
She did. She certainly did. But yeah, as soon as I that scene started, I was like, oh, bathtub scene. I think I know where we're going here.
Yeah.
But I also, it's funny because I would also say in some ways, you know, you could tie some of this back towards the fireworks woman.
I'm listening.
Because you have a community that is sort of dealing with sexual repression. And we see that through the character of Jim, who has left the Hittites to sort of, he's the first one of their community to basically step away and go find himself in the world, which is something that like, Amish teenagers actually do.
Rum Springer, like, baby.
Yeah, but there was a whole like reality show, I think, and like about that, which I thought was interesting. And then we also see, I'm trying to find Jeff East's character's name. What was that?
John,
yes. Sorry, it's so memorable. I forgot it. But we see John, who is one of the members of, what's his face's brother?
He sure is. Another Craven connection. He's from Summer of Fear. See our last episode.
Yes. But his character is also the brother of Jim in
right,
Martha.
Right, right, right.
Yeah. Or the brother-in-law of Martha, brother of Jim.
Right.
And son of Ernie Borgnine over there.
Right.
And so we see him, he's struggling because he's due to marry this woman within the community and doesn't like, isn't feeling it, I guess. And so you see him sort of toying with, you know, wanting to break out a little bit. And we see him like, you know, go off with Vicky, if I'm not mistaken, that was the one, right? Susan Buckner's character.
Correct.
Yes.
Patty Simcox.
But we get to see, you know, so his character sort of has like a very sexual reaction to, you know, basically the chick Melissa not wanting to sort of kiss him, I guess, or anything, because they're due to be married. So, you know, not supposed to touch each other or whatever it is that they're doing over there. Those Hittites. But yeah, it was like with the way that it's shot and sort of that idea of sexual repression, you know, I was like, oh, this is a lot less penis. Yes. No penis, actually.
Zero penis to be found. And actually, in a lot of ways, I find this to be one of, if not Wes Craven's most kind of feminist movie. Because it's essentially a story that's really entirely about women, especially as is revealed in the closing moments. It's about, you know, a group of women who find strength in one another. It's about how terrible men are, because almost all of the men in this movie are awful, with the exception of Jeff, who's, or not Jeff,
Jim. I know we're dealing with some pretty
Jeff,
involved
Jim,
names here.
John. He's, you know, killed very early on, so he becomes rather ineffectual in the story. Most of the other men are awful, and big spoilers for the end of Deadly Blessing. The reveal at the end of the film is very much kind of a sleepaway camp situation, where it is revealed that Louisa's daughter, Faith, is actually a man that she has raised as a girl because she never wanted a son. She's talking throughout the movie about how, you know, how she hopes Martha's baby.
Girls are important, yeah.
Right. She hopes Martha's baby is a girl because, boy, she would never want a son. And so we have a male character who wants anything else than to be a man. So there's a lot of feminism kind of throughout the movie. Another reason why there's no penis.
That's very true, even though there could have been. It's interesting because I wonder, you know, because you mentioned, of course, sort of that reveal of Faith later on in the movie. And I always made me wonder because, you know, I remember seeing Sleepaway Camp and that reveal at the end of that movie, like just completely blowing my mind as a kid. And I have to wonder, like, because this movie kind of came and went, do you think that this sort of ended up inspiring Sleepaway Camp in a little bit? Because, you know, we're also dealing with a slasher there as well.
It's certainly possible, yeah. I feel like the reveal in Sleepaway Camp is handled better.
Oh, absolutely.
A, because it's more graphic. We see actual penis, something this movie is sorely lacking. And B, we have a character say, she's a boy. And this movie... If you looked away from the screen or you got distracted by your phone or something for a second, you might actually miss the reveal.
Yeah. Yeah, very true. It's played very subtly and sort of, yeah, it's, you think that would be like a thing, right? Like that feels like that should be a bigger moment in the movie.
Yeah.
But it even goes even crazier from there in right. terms of, The giant incubus that rises up from the ground at the end, which then I was like, what?
Which ruins the movie for me, because one of the more interesting things for me about the movie is, you know, again, it's Wes Craven, who was raised very, very religious, and we've seen him sort of working that out through a number of his films, including The Fireworks Woman. So we kind of have another Craven connection here. This movie is deeply critical of this Hittite religion. They are assholes. They are hypocrites. They are backwards. They are brutally mean and abusive. and they are essentially painted as wrong. So he's very critical of the religion. So then to reveal that the incubus is real proves that they were right the whole time. And I don't think you can have a movie where you're criticizing them for their beliefs for the entire movie and then all of a sudden say, oh, but they were right. The incubus is real and it's a thing that should be feared because it's going to bust up out of your floor and take you away to hell.
Yeah, it definitely in that moment, it feels very much like at odds with each other in terms of what the point of this movie was supposed to be. I mean, who knows what the point was supposed to, I mean, I
well, that ending was, I believe, forced on him by producers. Very much the same way that the ending of A Nightmare on Elm Street, which is essentially the same ending, something,
yeah,
you know, breaks through and pulls somebody down, or, you know, in Nightmare on Elm Street, it's through the little window, and here it's through the floor, but was forced on him by Bob Shea. This ending was forced on him by producers as well, so we have another Craven connection there.
I love that we're making all these. One day we should, like, try to figure out a whole way to, like, chart these things. Like, for realsies.
That's a job for the listeners.
Yeah. That's homework, guys.
It's like that Beautiful Mind GIF.
Yes. Or Charlie from
Oh, yeah.
It's Always Sunny.
Yeah, that's, definitely.
Yes. That's a good one, too. Yeah, it you know, they're definitely, you know, as I was watching this, I was like, okay, I could see where he was starting to sort of rev up his creative engine, so to speak, heading into something like A Nightmare on Elm Street here. Because there, you know, obviously the idea of dreams comes into play at times, you know, the shower, the bathtub scene, you know, that sort of crazy weird ending that sort of just feels a little forced. Not that I would even call the one on Nightmare on Elm Street forced, even though I know it is. I mean, I still remember being shocked by it as a kid.
Well, the one on Nightmare on Elm Street, as much as he disliked it, it at least,
it's still pretty awesome.
And it makes, well, it's handled kind of poorly just because of Ronnie Blakely's, like, mannequin legs, but whatever.
Yeah.
It still makes sense because it's a character that we've been watching throughout this entire movie, and you're saying you thought he was dead. He's not really dead. For them to just introduce the idea of the incubus in the last 30 seconds of this movie. Yeah, right, exactly. It's like, wait,
she's like
a second.
Mrs. Voorhees.
You weren't welcome to the movie, Incubus, you fuck.
Yeah, no, absolutely. She should have, the Incubus should have worn like a nice blue sweater. But she's like, oh, what are you doing here?
I think it should have been the band Incubus should have come up out of the floor.
Oh, I feel like that was a little too ahead of their time, though.
Maybe.
Yeah, so I did think of the
also,
band
I'm
Incubus.
Also, I'm not a fan of the band Incubus.
Oh, it's okay. Winnie, shut up. Sorry. Someone's looking for my attention. Yeah, I'm trying to think of, do I like Incubus? I know they had that one song that was on the radio like all the time.
Wish You Were Here?
Yes. That's, yeah,
that's the only one I can name, I think.
Yeah. Oh, they are from Calabasas, though. And only the greatest music comes from Calabasas. So I'm just joking. That's like a Richie person neighborhood. So.
Oh, got it.
Yeah, I think that's where Kim Kardashian and Kanye live now. So,
oh,
it was a California joke.
Got it. I just picture all of them as like wearing shell necklaces, and
they
maybe that's wrong. But I feel like that was very popular when they were in.
Yeah, I'm trying to, I'm looking at photos. Boy, they went through a lot of identities. I don't see any shell necklaces.
Okay,
so.
I think when I was in grad school. When I was in grad school, I was teaching classes, and I had a student who loved Incubus, and he wore a shell necklace every day. So maybe I'm just conflating the two.
The puka shells?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. And he
loved
Incubus.
Well, one guy had dreads for a while, so.
Oh.
There's that. Interesting. Yeah, they went through a lot of iterations or sort of identities.
They're still around,
they're no,
right?
They're, I think they're. No Creed, though. I'm sure they're still around.
No, Creed is a worse band. I don't really like Incubus, but Incubus just isn't my thing. Creed is like bad.
Yeah. Did you ever see The Death of Dick Long?
No.
Okay. It is a movie that goes into places you really can't expect it to go.
Okay.
But their use of Creed in that movie is kind of the most genius thing I've ever seen.
Okay.
So that's all I can tell you, but I just forewarn you, it's going to make you really uncomfortable watching it, but it's also sort of endearing, and I don't know how to explain it without ruining the movie, so I can't say anything more.
So I should see this movie is what you're saying.
I feel like you might actually find something to appreciate out of it.
Okay.
Yeah. It's, yeah. I don't want to say anything else, but it's one of those, I remember watching it at Fantastic Fest a few years ago, and like, just everybody was like, what the hell is going on? Like, we all start, like, in a dark theater, we all start looking at each other like, what is happening? But the use of Creed actually works really well.
The cover art here on Amazon appears to be a guy spraying fire from his penis.
Yes.
Okay.
Leading to the death of Dick Long.
Got it. Does he have like an infection? Is this like a UTI kind of a thing?
I can't really tell you because it's but if I tell you how he dies, it kind of gives away where there's this really strange road that the movie takes you down.
All right, I will not ask.
Okay, yeah, it's a movie that you have to see to believe, to be honest. So,
and it's got some Creed in it.
It does. There's a lot of Creed references that happened after that movie.
You know what movie has a ton of Creed in it?
Creed?
Yeah, you're exactly right. It's Creed. Also Creed 2.
Ah, nice. Nice.
You know what movie has next to no Creed in it?
Deadly Blessing.
Deadly Blessing is correct. Wow, you are 2 for 2.
I'm so good at this game. I am killing it.
You are the reigning champion.
Yes, of Creed trivia, I guess. Creed trivia.
Did you notice that Summer of Fear was playing on the marquee when Susan Buckner goes to the movies?
I thought that's what it was. I just saw the fear part because I looked down for a second because I was writing notes, and then I looked up and I saw fear, and I was like, did it say something? I'm like, so that was correct, right?
Yeah. Yes. It was playing Summer of Fear. And she comes out of the movie and meets up with Jeff East, who's in Summer of Fear, yet she has no reaction like, hey, I just saw you in that movie.
So strange. So strange. I love it. Yeah, I actually kind of like their car scene a lot. Because it sort of feels very urban legend-y. And I don't necessarily mean urban legend the movie, but I just, of the whole, like, two lovers parked in a car right. in the middle of nowhere, and, like, they hear a noise. So I like the atmosphere of that, and, like, it's kind of, like, dark and a little foggy. So I thought that was a really fun setup for me.
The screenwriters on the Scream Factory Blu-ray are interviewed, and they essentially give credit to Wes Craven for rewriting their script and adding all of the stuff that's scary.
So basically they were making Witness, and then Wes Craven right. said, why don't we do something different? And then they made Deadly Blessing.
But like the scene in the barn where Sharon Stone is trapped, or the spider dream, I don't think they specify the car sequence, but it's like all the stuff in the movie that works, where you can feel him kind of flexing some of his muscles that he would perfect on later films, I think all comes from him. And that's what's interesting about the movie. Not that it's a particularly successful film on its own, but to see those little hints of what's to come from him. Because it is, you know, he's making a different kind of movie than he's made already. And it's each movie has gotten progressively more polished. You know, he's again working with a studio here, which is maybe his first time working with a studio. He's working with some bigger stars. Again, like I mentioned, Ernie B. and Sharon Stone, who we haven't even talked about. Another Craven connection.
Oh, yes.
Your mother is no Sharon Stone.
Yes. He knew what he was doing.
He did. His whole career is like a big meta joke.
It's kind of genius, like the way, like, do you think he just sat around like all day and just came up with all these like things? Like, one day I'm going to work this into a script.
I assume like, so.
Like, that's just like the saddest part about all of this is like that ultimately, like when we're done with this, like we can't sit down and have this conversation with him.
Right.
And that bums me out, I think, the most.
Yeah.
to really go in and sort of nitpick all of those fun little like moments for fans to like be able to be like, so you were really doing this here, weren't you? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just kind of bums me out. I mean, it bums me out in general, but you know, but yeah, it was interesting that you mentioned, of course, him working with the studio, but the studio actually ended up dumping this movie before they released it.
Yes, they did.
Thank you. Yeah, good job, Universal. Very, very supportive. Because Universal was putting out, it was Polygram, right? And
yeah.
Then it was UA that eventually distributed it.
Yeah.
But
I think it was before United Artists was being distributed by MGM.
Yes. So many deals going down in the 80s with all these like little companies and such. But yeah, so they ended up dumping it and United Artists put it out.
Yeah. And it was not a success.
Yeah. I don't think it was.
Made about $8 million.
I mean, this movie probably cost maybe $1 million to make.
Yeah, I mean, it's not terrible. Yeah.
No. You know, so. Oh, good. The world's ending outside.
Oh, well.
Yeah, it's interesting because also, you know, you have Michael Berryman in here as well, as I mentioned.
Craven Connection.
Yes, of course, Hills Have Eyes. And just all around nice dude to begin with.
Yeah.
But I love that his last name is Glunt in this movie. They're like, what is the most weird, awkward last name we could give somebody? And they're like, how about Glunt?
Well, and he's like the kind of the town weirdo. And so his name is, I think, only ever spoken as a first and last name. So he's always that William Glunt.
Yeah. It's almost like he's like a wrestler. Like back in the 80s, you'd always give, like, they'd always do wrestling promos. So they'd have to say somebody's first name and last name.
Yeah.
Be like, I'm coming for you, Randy Savage. Not coming for you, Randy.
Right.
We're not.
They should have just called each other by by first names in wrestling.
Yeah. I mean, now it's sort of in vogue to sort of drop the last names off of people or their first names. It's really weird.
Okay.
So, like, there's a wrestler right now whose name is Matt Riddle, and they're just calling him Riddle now.
Okay, got it.
But it also...
Not Matt. I'm coming for you, Matt.
Coming for you, Matt. But
you're going
also,
down, he's got, Matt.
He's also got sexual assault allegations, so that might be a Google search thing, as some people have hypothesized, so...
Oh.
Yes, wrestling is not what it used to be, although I think it's just because they were better at hiding it back then.
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
Probably. But yeah, so it's just funny, like when they say William Glunt, and it's very, very 80s pro wrestling, which I enjoy.
And William Glunt is, of course, the first victim in this movie, and the last victim for like at least an hour. It's a slasher movie with, oh, that's right. I forgot about Jim.
I forgot
Jim getting mauled by the
tractor. Does anybody remember about Jim?
Right? Jim's kind of a piece of white bread.
He is. I looked him up last night because I was like, have I seen this guy in anything? And I'm like, no, not really.
He's in Space Invaders.
Yeah, I guess he was like apparently he's been a director for a while, doing a lot of TV movies and stuff. But
yeah, he's got a fairly lengthy resume, but mostly TV, it looks like.
Yeah, because I felt like the name sounded familiar to me, but then when I looked him up, I was like, nope, not at all.
Well, and Maren Jensen is mostly a TV star at this point. And that's the thing, is like Deadly Blessing...
It feels like a TV movie.
Feels like a TV movie, yeah, except for there's like two scenes with some nudity that were shot by a body double. But with the exception of that gratuitous nudity, this could absolutely be a TV movie. James Horner's score, I think, sounds like a TV score.
Yeah, that was another thing that kind of surprised me, that this was James Horner, because, like, it doesn't...
There's no memorable theme or anything like that.
I don't feel emotion in this score, like, whatsoever. Like, I think the first time I ever really remembered, like, a Horner score was Wrath of Khan.
Oh my gosh, that's one of the best scores ever.
Yeah, and because it has, like, so much emotion to it.
Yes.
So this is, I mean, you know, obviously this is pretty early on in his career, but I was like, wow, this is kind of, it's all right.
Well, I was watching the movie with my wife, Erica, and during the bathtub sequence, she was busy working on something, and she kind of perked up. She goes, whoa, this sounds so much like the music from Psycho. And
oh,
then she played the shower scene before the shower scene, not the famous strings, the Bernard Herrmann strings, but right. like everything leading up to that, where she's flushing the thing down the toilet and all that. And she played it. I was like, oh yeah, there are definite echoes. So I wonder if that was intentional homage or shameless ripoff. Given there's what's so happening scores... on screen, I have to believe it's intentional homage since.
Oh, yeah. And yeah. It's funny because, like, there's so many scores I listen to now, especially from, like, the 80s, where I was like, wow, I guess these things sort of, like, flew over my head as a kid. But now, I guess being an adult and you kind of start, like, paying attention to these things, I'm like, yeah. a lot of people out there owe Bernard Herrmann some checks, is all I'm saying.
Well, most famously is Richard Band. Right.
Oh, yes. I would also argue there's some stuff in some yes. Friday 13th scores as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Definitely.
I feel like Manfredini owed some money to Herrmann as well. But
Manfredini also owes money to himself because he just recycled one score for eight movies. Seven movies,
genius,
I guess.
Genius, though.
Six and a half.
But they're all memorable in some weird little way.
Yeah.
Because like, there's a lot of times, like especially like if you play like the Friday 13th game, like you can... Jason... Like you can hear the music, like when you play as different Jasons, like the music cues are different. So it's like one of those, like, oh, it's Jason 6 coming, you know. So they're at least memorable enough to yeah. where they feel different, but at their core, they're all very similar.
Here's a question. Let me ask your opinion on this. I just pre-ordered the Jason Takes Manhattan score from Waxworks Records.
Interesting.
Well, listen, it's the first one that Manfredini didn't do. I mean, he did half of New Blood, I think. And then the Jason Takes Manhattan score is a synth score by somebody else. I don't remember who. And honestly, I'm a completist because I have the first seven. So I was like, well, they're putting out eight. I got to get eight. Do you think they stop there or do they go on to Jason Goes to Hell and Jason X?
I mean, if you're going to be a real completist, you have to go. You have to go for it. Although I don't know if you do the remake, because I honestly don't even remember the score of the remake.
Apologies to whoever
did the remake. But I mean, everybody likes to just poop all over Jason Goes to Hell, and I'm not one of those people.
I'm not either.
I like it a lot more than eight.
I do too.
Yeah, because I mean, for me, eight is just kind of boring.
Eight is my least favorite of all of them.
Yeah. So you'd be very pleased to know that I did watch five a little bit here and there
mm-hmm,
in October.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I'm still really sold at it, but you know,
are you sure?
It's better than eight.
It's better than eight.
It's better than seven.
It's better than seven. I like this. It's moving up the ranks.
It is. I mean, even though I think seven has probably one of the best Jason designs, but
I don't like zombie Jason.
Oh, I do. Yeah. In terms of when you get to Zombie Jason, like, I like that a little. He just feels a little more organic than, like, six. Six, he's a little clean for me.
Sure.
He's got, like, the little pocket knife holder and stuff, and I'm like, "Who? You went to REI before you got married? Like, what happened here?
REI layman.
So I like the nice. But, like, it feels a little more organic in Seven to me, that look. Like, if he's, like, undead Jason, like, so he should kind of look that way.
Yeah.
And that spine in the back, just, I love it. I just want to, like, play the xylophone on it.
Weird.
Yeah, I do. But, yeah, Eight is just...
And, you know, it's some people's favorite.
I mean, sure.
I know a few people online who'd name that as their favorite. The music for the remake was done by Steve Jablonski. Just wanted to make sure we gave old Jablo his
Steve
due.
Steve Jablonski.
So. <Yeah.
laughs> Old Jablo. like we're best friends with him?
Yep.
Yeah.
Gotta make sure.
Well, it makes sense that he did that because I just looked and he did all the other... Platinum Dunes ones. Like the Texas Chainsaw remake actually had a really good score, but that also might have been from Jay Flood doing stuff because he did a lot of stuff with them too. Interesting.
I remember the music from the trailer and that's it because I don't revisit that movie very often because I'm not crazy about it.
The Texas Chainsaw remake?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I mean, I get it. It's, you know, Toby. It's all right.
Yeah.
That's... I like that. I don't like the beginning as much.
Okay.
Yeah. But I also saw that like the night before I had to have surgery and I think it was just like too much and I was like, I'm out. But I guess Jablonski did some stuff for Transformers.
Sure.
So there you go. And also, of course, the memorable score that I can't think of from a Nightmare on Elm Street remake, which we talked about in Horror BFFs.
Yes, we did. And that movie's not good.
Yeah. So, yeah, I was trying to think of like, oh, maybe we've got some, but it's all pretty much kind of like these weird generic-y type action-y movies.
Okay. Well, he sounds like maybe a Michael Bay guy if he's doing Transformers and Platinum Dunes.
Yeah. I mean, no offense to Skyscraper because Skyscraper rules, but.
I have never seen it.
You know what? I think you would enjoy it.
It looked so green screeny to me that I kind of, I'm not a big disaster movie guy to begin with. And then it looked so, which was why I skipped San Andreas. And then Skyscraper looked very green screeny.
See, this is, here's why I like Skyscraper. So you have in this movie, you have Dwayne Johnson married to Nev Campbell. So first
all your worlds are coming together.
Exactly. So already my worlds are merging into this one place. But here's the best part. She is she's a very active participant,
mm-hmm.
and she's like she actually has action scenes.
Okay.
So that to me, I was really surprised because I was like, well, I figured they were building the whole movie up around my buddy Dwayne.
Right.
And actually she kind of rules in it as well. So that for me made it well worth my time.
Okay.
So it's definitely way better than San Andreas.
Which I also haven't seen. Yeah.
That's okay. You don't really need to.
No.
It's ridiculous and
it's got Carla Gugino though, so
it does. I feel like they waste her in that movie though.
What a surprise.
And Daddario's in it too.
Oh my goodness.
And that's actually shocking.
I just realized I've wasted my life.
I know, but she never says to Dwayne, you know, do your thing, cuz. So it really is just.
Why put her in a movie if she's not going to say, do your thing, cuz?
Exactly.
That's a movie I like better than Friday 8.
Yeah, I think I do too, even though it makes no sense whatsoever.
Listen, we can't go applying logic to movies.
I mean, you're right. You know, for 40, she looks really good. So.
She's keeping it together.
Yeah. She looks great for 40. Let me just put it this way. I'm 42 and I look 42. She's 40 and she looks 21 in that movie. So good for her.
Yeah. Yeah. No, she's keeping it together. Back to Deadly Blessing.
Yes.
This is the first, I believe, feature film appearance of one Sharon Stone, who apparently had a hard time working with Wes Craven because he's not known for being an actor's director, or at least wasn't at this time, and she was struggling, this being her first time in a film. She has received criticism for her performance. I didn't really have a problem with it. I thought she's good in the movie.
I thought she was fine. You know, that was the thing that I really liked about this movie, because like, I feel like if you made this movie now, at some point in the movie, there would be this like, there'd be some conflict that arises between these three women, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like something, we got to do something where some stupid secret is revealed. Hold on. I'm about to beat my dog. not really, of course.
No.
She's so much. Shut your mouth. But like there, like if you made this movie now, there'd be some sort of like reveal of like Lana slept with Jim at some point.
Yes, absolutely.
Now she feels bad. And what I really liked about this was that you had three women who were genuine friends, who were looking out for each other, who were there to support each other, all very positive.
Feminist movie, I'm telling you.
Yeah. And it was really nice to see that where it wasn't, there was no conflict because of them.
Right.
Where if this movie happened now, there'd be some sort of stupid reveal and
100%.
Yeah. But I really, you know, cause like Lana comes in and she's like the bombshell, you know, she's always wearing like the cleavagey type outfits and stuff, such things.
Especially
like
on
that.
The poster.
Yeah.
Pull up the poster for this movie, it's so ridiculous. It's Sharon Stone with dark hair. And then they put her in this insanely low cut, like nightgown that she's not wearing in the movie. It's
like, she's not in a giallo.
Right. It's almost offensive. Like how.
Yeah. That's like a giallo nightgown.
Yeah. Anyway, you were saying.
There's no practicality to that. Yeah. So, but that's what I really, you know, as I said, like, I wouldn't call this one of Craven's, like, better efforts. Not that I think it's, like, bad or anything. It's just there. But I really appreciate it, I guess, in its sort of earnestness towards like sort of the friendships in this movie.
Yeah.
And even the conflict that they have still feels kind of safe. I don't know if that's even the right word. You know, I don't think anything in this movie feels overly dramatic, I guess. But I do like the fact that it's like these women who are just there to support each other, get Martha through her rough times, until the incubus takes her away.
Which is just a big fuck you of an ending. Sharon Stone. Go ahead.
I was going to say also, like, they make a big deal at the beginning of mentioning that Martha's pregnant, and then it's literally not a part of the movie for the rest of it.
Well, that's why she doesn't go to California. She said the seed is planted.
Right. But I mean, like, in general, like, it's like we're basically we end a movie with a pregnant woman being dragged down to hell.
Right.
Which is kind of crazy.
Yeah.
You know, it's always sort of interesting because, you know, especially like in 80s horror, it was very rare to put pregnant women like in that predicament.
Right.
Like, which is always, it's like always interesting to me, like with like Friday 3, where they have the one.
Such a weird thing to reveal in that movie.
Yeah. Where she's like, I'm going to have a beer. Right. No, I don't want the beer, but I kind of want the beer. I shouldn't eat the pot though, but you know. It's always interesting to me when they sort of introduce those elements, but they don't quite, it just like, it's never really like a thing that her and her friends really discuss all that much.
Like, no, right. At no point
she wants to stay
after she beats the snake in the bathtub with the nobody's like, oh gosh, is the baby okay? You know, nobody's really concerned about the health of the baby.
No, there's no, you know, she's had a big traumatic loss. She never like goes to the doctor to be like, you know, maybe just my stress levels, right. Check out my blood pressure, make sure everything's okay. No. So, and now the baby's in hell with the incubus.
I think limbo. I think unborn babies go to limbo.
Oh, okay. Am I going to hell now for saying that? Is that what that is?
We're both going to hell.
I know.
With the band incubus.
With the band incubus and our puka shell necklaces.
Because for sure, they're going to hell. Crimes against our ears. Sharon Stone never really makes another horror movie. She becomes queen of like the thriller in the 90s, but never really makes another full-on horror movie. And it was funny because as we're watching it, again, my wife is commenting on how beautiful Sharon Stone is. And she would say, like, imagine being Susan Buckner and you're the most beautiful girl in your high school and you go to Hollywood and you're going to make it. And then they put you in a movie and you're with Sharon Stone and suddenly you feel less than, you know, and she said the same thing about Maren Jensen. Like, again, so beautiful. Opposite Sharon Stone, like nobody stands a chance. But yeah, I thought she was good in the movie and she really did put a spider in her mouth. So I give her credit for that.
Hell no. Hell no.
That scene is a nightmare.
Yeah. Nope. Nope. Thank you. And it's like, also like, I find it interesting that like, they basically use tarantulas for this movie. Like I would, you know, if you're on a farm, like there's a lot of spiders that are crawling around a lot of the places, but like, are tarantulas like really just wild there? I don't
know. Not that I know of, but I haven't been on a ton of farms.
Yeah. But it's interesting to me that like every spider in that movie is like a tarantula.
Yeah.
Which I'm like, tarantulas don't really live in the wild like that. but it did remind me, my mom, I when I was a kid, my mom had a boyfriend who lived with us and he had a tarantula in a cage.
Yes, you've talked about that before. And that is terrifying to me.
Yeah. No, thank you. but yeah, that scene in specifically, I was like, oh my God. Because I'd always heard about it. And again, it was one of those, like, I remember it as a kid. And of course, all of these things like kind of kept flooding back to me. As I was watching it and I was like, this might be the start of my hatred of spiders.
Yeah.
Cause that is just no thank you. And like, even if the thing is defanged, no.
Right.
No.
Yeah. My issue isn't that the spider might have fangs.
No, it's a spider.
My issue is that there's a spider in my mouth. Yeah. And this is what earned, Sharon Stone the nickname Old Spider Mouth for most of the 80s.
Is that what it was? I thought it was something else.
No, it was Old Spider Mouth.
Old Spider Mouth. All right.
That's why it was such a big deal when she got Basic Instinct, because it finally got rid of that nickname.
I was going to say, I don't know where that joke's going, but...
No, yeah, she finally was able to shed the nickname because because of that leg crossing scene.
Oh, I thought you're doing the shed. Her, the nickname is like a molting reference to the spider.
What? No.
Okay.
I'm not thinking. You're four steps ahead.
Maybe I am. I guess I am.
Three-dimensional chess.
I know. I will say this because I just recently covered the show with the one Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
What? Oh, Ratchet?
Ratchet. That's, yes. God, I was like, I can think of Mildred. I can think of her first name, but I couldn't think of Nurse Ratchet. But I recently covered Ratchet a few months ago and got to see Sharon Stone up close. And she is still absolutely stunning, and it's ridiculous.
Is she good on that show? Did you watch the show?
I did, yeah. She has a crazy over-the-top character in it. The show itself...
I have an allergy to Ryan Murphy, so I avoided the show.
Shocking. It's interesting because it wasn't the show that I thought it was going to be, and ended up being a little more drama. I do think it has like a lot of issues storytelling wise. But ultimately it's very, again, sort of female empowerment.
Okay.
I'm curious to see, cause they've already planned a season two for those. But it was better than I was expecting, but I wouldn't call it amongst my favorite Ryan Murphy shows.
Got it. What would you call amongst your favorite Ryan Murphy shows?
Scream Queens.
Oh God, I forgot. Scream Queens.
So sorry. I also grew up, but like in my 20s, I spent most of my 20s watching Nip Tuck. So
I watched all of Nip Tuck and liked it at the beginning, but by the end, we were hate watching it.
I was kind of hate watching it by the end too. I feel like that show should have ended two seasons earlier than it did.
Every FX show was like, we were so on board at the beginning. That's true of like Sons of Anarchy. It's true of Rescue Me. It's true of Nip Tuck. And by the end, I think we were hate watching all of them.
I think The Shield is like the only one, I think, of FX shows that never really outstayed its welcome.
I've never seen an episode of The Shield.
I've never seen Breaking Bad. We're even.
All right. Yeah. No, I saw all of Breaking Bad. Never saw The Shield. And I've always wanted to see The Shield. But for whatever reason, that's the one I missed. Yeah.
Yeah. I actually liked The Shield. But yeah, it was one of those Breaking Bad started like right as I was kind of like stopped watching TV.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was like every single person was just like, oh my God, are you watching Breaking Bad? Oh my God, Breaking Bad. And I was just like, you know what? I'm done. You guys have your Breaking Bad. I'm out.
I'm going to watch Scream Queens.
Exactly, which is awesome, and you're so wrong on that.
I only saw the first season. I don't think I ever saw season two. Season two had a complete season, right?
It did, yeah. Okay. It's not nearly as well-oiled as I think the first season was, but it has its moments. I mean, it's some really fun stuff with Stamos in it, so.
Okay.
You know, I mean, it's Jamie Lee Curtis and Emma Roberts. Like, how do you...
I like half of those things.
It's mathematically impossible for me not to like that show. So, yeah. Well, I'm sorry that you're wrong about Emma Roberts.
Did you watch Holiday?
I have not yet. I've been waiting on my holiday movies until after Thanksgiving. So
got it.
So I haven't had a chance yet.
A lot of Emma Roberts there.
Okay. That's all right.
Yeah. So you'll probably like it, is my point.
Oh, I'm sure I will. I never got to watch the pizza one.
No, but our friend Adam.
I know Risky loves it.
Little Italy, yeah.
He's the best.
Yeah, no, he's a big Emma Roberts fan. You guys can bond over your love of Emma Roberts.
I think he tweeted about that recently, where he's like, am I an Emma Roberts fan now? And I was like, yes, thank you. did he tell you how he messaged me to tell me that he actually really likes Face the Music now?
Really? Okay.
He's like, I think you won me over. He's like, because I watched it again and I really liked it. Or something like that. And I was like, yes, I won again.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Good job.
Sometimes I do some good in the world.
Yeah. Good job. So back to Deadly Blessing. Back to the movie at hand. The Hittites end up being a total red herring. You don't even need them in this movie.
No, you don't.
Because had the killer been one of them, perhaps, then there would be a reason for them to be in this movie. But the killer is not. The killer is completely unrelated to the Hittites. The only thing that makes them matter is sort of that they're right about the incubus. And it's another example of Wes Craven kind of doing this worlds colliding thing that he had done already on in Last House on the Left and The Hills Have Eyes, yeah. Right, where we have these sort of two opposing groups clashing, and here it's the townspeople with the Hittites, and there's no real love lost between them. Making Jeff an outcast is kind of interesting, but again, that really goes nowhere because he's killed so early that it almost doesn't matter.
Yeah, it becomes very much a non-factor. I mean, I guess you don't really know until you see the movie, though, because, you know, a lot of the movie, they sort of set up these things where they're like, well, maybe it is them,
right?
You know, going around and doing these right. things. But then ultimately, no.
It's not. It completely comes out of left field. And again, Roger Ebert's law of economy of characters dictates that it kind of has to be either Louisa or Faith, because why else are they in this movie, right? They keep popping back up to remind you, hey, I exist. And so that by the end, it at least pays off where you're like, oh, that's why you were in this movie so much. We're supposed to remember you because you have to be the killer. Killers, I should say. But yeah, it renders...
Faith was bringing eggs, so there's that.
A lot of eggs. Like crazy amounts of eggs. Too many eggs. That's like Cool Hand Luke numbers of eggs.
Yeah, I don't know that, like, I don't know that I would call this one of the most sort of stellar efforts from Craven, but I don't think a lot of that is his fault necessarily. Like, you know, obviously he's working with a script, with a studio, they're cool with the project the way it is. You know, he's done what he can in terms of the genre stuff. You know, but I do think it's funny because, like, the first, like, two-thirds of this movie just kind of, like, float by. It's very, like, you know, it's actually paced pretty well. And then it's, like, all of a sudden, everything starts happening all at once at the end.
Right.
Where, like, you know, it's, like, you know, Lana has her nightmare. And then all of a sudden, it's just, like, you know, Martha figures out Jim's been dug up. James, I'm now introducing a James into the character. Too many J names. But he's been dug up, which, again, it feels so weird. Like, why? Like, and then right. his body's, like, in the barn all tied up really weird, which,
Vicky
again,
and
like,
John get blown up.
Yeah.
Actually, John gets stabbed, I should say.
Yeah, John gets stabbed. You know, she gets blown up. It's so strange, like, how, like, for as sort of evenly paced as the rest of the movie is, like, that last 20 minutes, they're like, all right, let's throw it, like, let's just go for it. And it does feel like, again, a little bit at odds with what has come before it.
Yeah.
Because, like, a lot of it's just sort of like this, like, sort of weird, like, sort of creepy, like, oh, make sure you lock your doors kind of movie, check your windows, because somebody could be lurking out there, which we know they are. And then all of a sudden it's just like, all right, we're digging up corpses and, you know, we were revealing characters to be men, and like it's strange. But again, I think it's if you're looking at what comes after this, I think it definitely shows like a pattern of like where, you know, if you look at where Wes was before to where Wes goes from here, there's a growth. And I think that's something like for me when I'm like looking at directors these days, like I just want to see growth.
Yeah.
You know, because even if I don't like somebody's like first movie or second movie or something like that, like that doesn't mean I'm not going to like anything from them ever. And one of my biggest examples is like Johannes Roberts. Cause he did this movie called like Storage 24 a few years ago, which had really cool, like visual effects. The story was terrible. The movie was really shot poorly. It just wasn't my thing. And then he's gone on to do like really cool stuff and ended up like doing really like the Strangers Pray at Night.
Mm hmm.
You know, which I know you're a big fan of that pool scene.
I am.
Yes. You know, so it's like I never discount a director if I don't necessarily gel with some of their earlier stuff, because you never know what's going to come after. And I think if you look at where Wes had been and where Wes was heading sort of towards like this, I don't want to say authoritative voice, but like being accepted into the studio system, which during the 80s was very important to any director's career, no matter what they're going to tell you. You know, a lot of directors want to be renegades and things like that. And, you know, even somebody like Carpenter, if you look at him, he's a guy who, you know, who he feels like he's anarchy. He's walking anarchy as a director. But he was still a guy who wanted to work with the studios because that's where you get the money. That's where you get the budgets and things like in being able to sort of play in a bigger sandbox. So I do appreciate a lot of what this movie does because it eventually leads to bigger things for Wes as a storyteller.
Yeah, it's, you know, if we're going to agree that two of his best movies are A Nightmare on Elm Street and Scream, those are like both his two big slasher movies, and this is kind of his first swing at doing a slasher movie. A lot of the imagery then becomes recycled in some of his later movies. And yeah, there's like Martha's Baby, the seeds have been planted here for some really good stuff. That's still
I think
to come.
I think my favorite quote in this movie, though, was the "you are a stench in the nostrils of God." Like, you paid Ernest Borgnine to say those words on screen.
He was nominated for a Razzie for this movie.
Which Razzies are so stupid, but I get it. But like, seriously, like, somebody paid Ernest Borgnine to say those words in a movie. Like, think about that. But also, what a great t-shirt. So,
I like it.
Yes, I kind of like it because it's a deep cut. but yeah.
You're all about those deep cut t-shirts.
I am. I will tell you, we've sold a few of the Abe Snake ones, though.
Nice. Yeah.
I think we've sold like six.
All right. That means so there's far. Six people walking around with a cool ass shirt.
That's right, they are. So yeah, so get them now, kids. Go to Redbubble, search for them. They're out there.
Directed by Abe Snake.
Yes, but yeah, it's, you know, like I said, I don't know in the grand scheme of things if I was going to pull out a Wes Craven, quote unquote, deep cut. If we're talking deep cuts, if this is one that I necessarily be like, yeah, let's do that. But at the same time, like, I find it to be pretty. I don't know. I feel like, because I saw like the Rotten Tomatoes is like really, really low. It's like 17% or 14%.
Oh, wow.
Or something like that. And I feel like that's a little excessive. Like, there's nothing really offensive about this movie. It's just there. It's, you know, it's a little bland at times, but I also sort of like how it just sort of feels like a warm summer day for a lot of it. I don't know how to explain it, if that makes any kind of sense. Probably not.
Well, I think the ending is kind of a disaster. I mean, obviously, you know, the reveal is problematic by 2020 standards, but yeah. the actual incubus is kind of a train wreck in terms of how to end this movie. But
and
I'm with
you. Barely get to see it,
right? It's covered in such a way that they didn't have the money, and I think I read that they spent like an extra $10,000 to shoot that ending.
Oh, geez.
But you barely get to see it the way it's covered. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I like enough of the movie that I'm able to hang with it, you know, and it helps knowing that it's Wes Craven and he would go on to do great things, because you can, like I said, see some of that in this movie. If this was like somebody's last movie, or if this was the best it ever got for some filmmaker, I don't know how much I would pay attention to it, but
yeah.
Because it's a Wes Craven movie, I'm looking for those things and I'm looking for signs of what's to come. Would you say this is like your least favorite of the ones we've covered so far?
See, I feel like that's almost like a detriment to the movie, because there's nothing that we've watched where I've been like, oh my God, that's horrible.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
But I think it pairs nicely with the Summer of Fear, because it does feel, you know, other than some quick nudity shots, it feels very much like a TV movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe he was sort of playing it safe a little bit because he, you know, come off doing TV movie, found pretty good success with that, because I think it did pretty well, Summer of Fear, when it was Stranger in Our House, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
did pretty well for NBC at the time. So maybe he was just kind of sticking with a formula he knew. But let's throw in a few new nudity shots and earn that R rating, I guess.
Right, right.
But I think in a lot of ways, I mean, beyond the whole Jeff East connection, I actually think it would pair very well with it in a lot of ways. Because you sort of have, even though you don't really know it in Deadly Blessing, but you sort of have, you know, women doing these things to other women.
Right, yeah, that's true.
You know, so there's kind of that aspect of it.
Yeah.
You know, so I hate to say it's my least favorite, like,
sure,
because I didn't hate it. It's right. Just there.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, so it's definitely in the, it's saying. Well, so few movies are. It's definitely kind of lower tier Wes Craven, you know.
Yeah, like if we were like at the end of this, and we probably will go through and like try to figure out where all of these movies rank.
Yeah.
You know, amongst our own particular fandoms. I mean, I definitely would see this on the lower end of the spectrum.
Yeah. Which makes sense. And Wes Craven would probably not argue with you if he were still here, you know?
Yeah. I don't feel like he would argue with us though. Cause I think he's like a genuinely nice guy.
So we could just say anything and he wouldn't argue?
Probably. I just feel like he'd be like, you know, maybe you're right. I get that sense. So, I mean, I only talked to him once for like 15 minutes. So, you know, I am clearly an authority on everything that he would say and do. So, but no, I feel like he'd be like, yeah, you know, he'd be like, that's okay. That's fine.
Yeah.
I feel like he'd understand.
All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for Deadly Blessing. So thanks for talking about this movie with me, Heather.
Oh, you are very welcome. And I feel like, you know, this conversation was not a stench in the nostrils of God.
Oh, hopefully nicely not. Done. Nicely done.
Yes.
Remember, you can follow us on Twitter at CravenCravenPod. We don't tweet very often, but maybe we'll start.
We'll get there.
Yeah.
It's been a rough couple of months, I think, for everybody.
You think?
You know, I don't know, like maybe late January, a lot of us will feel more like tweeting a little bit more.
Yeah.
You know, no reason in particular.
Right. Up next for us is Swamp Thing.
Yes, I'm excited because I really haven't, I have the Blu-ray, but I just haven't really watched it in a very, very, very long time.
Yeah.
So I'm excited.
Me too. I like that movie.
I remember really liking it as a kid, so yeah. I'm very excited to jump back into it.
And it's very different for him. Again, we're watching this filmmaker kind of find his voice, you know, in real time as we do this. And Swamp Thing is another step along that journey. So I'm excited to go back to it.
I'm excited to step back into the swamps myself.
Very nice. All right. Well, thank you guys very much for listening. We will talk to you next month.